The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. We discuss with the Trump re-election team who is the most vulnerable top Democrat.
There are some advantages to each.
Mark. You really want Elizabeth Warren, don't you? An ABC News anchor exposes her network.
There will come a day when we will realize Jeffrey Epstein was the most prolific pedophile this country has ever known. I had it all 3 years ago.
We look at the threat of war against Israel.
It's 130,000 rockets in the hands of Hezbollah that can reach the state of Israel.
And the little discussed actions of the Bidens in Ukraine.
He was fired because he refused to stand down the investigation of Burisma, and that upset Joe Biden.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live, 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time, and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com, and let me invite you to join us now by video. And, of course, follow me on Twitter, at Hugh Hewitt. And follow this program as well, at Town Hall Review. If you only read the mainstream media headlines, you might be inclined to believe Republicans got hammered in the elections on Tuesday. Democrats did indeed win the gubernatorial race in Kentucky, where Trump campaigned the night before, and newspapers celebrated that fact nationwide, run as they are primarily by left-wingers. But they often buried the big story. Republicans swept the rest of the key Kentucky statewide races, including the big win for Daniel Cameron, the first Republican attorney general elected in 70 years and the first black elected attorney general in the state of Kentucky ever. That's the good news on the Republican side. All in all, it was a good day in Kentucky, despite losing the governor's mansion. The day after, I spoke with Mark Lauder, the director of strategic communications for Trump Pence 2020. Trump voters are out there. They're strong. Am I right?
I think you've got it right. Absolutely right. And you have to look at Governor Bevin as an outlier. I mean, he was down to, 15, 17 points in polls, very recently. And I think the president nearly dragged him across the finish line. But you can only go so far when you have a governor who was that unpopular due to things that he had done. Nothing to do with the national scene.
This is exactly right. But then I got a comment from Zerlina Maxwell, one of my colleagues, a political analyst at MSNBC, saying, laughing at basically what my assessment was and saying, quote, you can only whip a racist base into a frenzy so many times. There are just more of us non-racists, and maybe folks will start to recognize that. That's actually honest of Zerlina. They really think Trump voters are racist. They're still stuck in the deplorable rut, Mark.
It doesn't surprise me. I mean, we see this almost every day coming out of many of the Democrats, and they just don't get the fact that there is a silent majority out there who wants leaders who will fight for their jobs, fight to lower taxes, fight to get government off their backs. And they view this as a racist trope. But you can take a look at that New York Times Siena poll from just earlier this week in the battleground states. It shows President Trump increasing his popularity or advantage with African Americans by anywhere from 5 to 11 points. And that has to scare the Democrats because it shows that his leadership is working and it's delivering.
Now, I got to say, what I see online, what I saw in the analysis in the Times and the Washington Post and the Manhattan Beltway media elite, they want Republicans to be depressed. I am a Republican. I am a faithful partisan. I am object. I am not depressed. I think it's a three-state election. I think you got to go live in Pennsylvania, Michigan, and Wisconsin, Mark, and that the president ought to be camping there on the weekends. Am I right, wrong, or a little bit off one way or the other?
Well, I don't think that anybody should be depressed, and I agree about those three states, but I'll throw out a couple of more. I'll also say New Hampshire, and I will say Minnesota. Both states that are pretty low, easily to be picked off. We've already got the resources there. I mean, give you an example. In Minnesota, in 2016, the campaign had two people there, and we spent about $30,000. We already have 20 people on the ground from our campaign and the RNC in Minnesota with plans to spend tens of millions of dollars We're not going to leave any state unturned, and I think there's a lot of opportunity for pickup out there.
Let me ask you, Mark, take your hat off. Not speaking officially for Donald Trump now. You really want Elizabeth Warren to be their nominee, don't you?
You know, I mean, there are some advantages to each.
No, come on, Mark. You really want Elizabeth Warren, don't you?
It looks like that's where it's headed right now, but we don't know if it's going to stay
there. Oh, Mark, come on. You really want Elizabeth Warren. This is just Mark Lauder, not the president. You really want her, don't you?
Yeah, I will tell you that, you know, it doesn't really matter which one.
No, you said yes. I heard you say yes, and everybody knows it. We saw those polls. She wants to take away union retirees' health plans. She wants to take the automobile workers and the steel workers and take away and the teachers of America and take away their health plans. How could you not want to run against
her? It's remarkable. It is really unbelievable when you look at the plans and the tax increases. And I mean, the fact that she just told 2 million people who work in the health insurance industry to go sell auto insurance or
yes!
to go work in life insurance. I mean, that's just absolutely crazy.
So are those 30
people telling you can't do it?
are those 30 Trump Pence workers in Minnesota out there getting people to the polls for Elizabeth Warren? Because I'm going to vote for her in the primary. I'm switching from Bernie Sanders to Elizabeth Warren. I used to be a Bernie Sanders voter in the Virginia primary next year. I'm going to be for Elizabeth Warren now. I think every Republican should be. How about you?
You know, I'll have to think about that one. I hate always switching over my voter registration because then I think there's repercussions down the road.
Yeah, well, I just got to say, we got to get her nominated because she's just everything that's wrong with the Democratic Party. I'm afraid Mike Bloomberg's going to get into this race. Are you?
I'm not afraid by it. I wouldn't be surprised by it. It's clear that the Democrats are not happy with any of the people in their field. And they know that none of these current candidates can actually beat President Trump. Not sure Bloomberg would do any better. I mean, this is a state that actually lost the president of the United States. They're losing so much population that they're going to lose a congressional seat in the next decade here when they realign Congress. This is not a question about the president. It's a question about bad leadership in New York causing people to flee.
In what ABC News anchor Amy Robach says is true, her network sat on the Jeffrey Epstein pedophilia story years before it broke. She's quite angry about it. But she did not take those thoughts public at the time. They were picked up on a camera and leaked to James O'Keefe of Project Veritas. ABC claims the reporting didn't meet their standards. And at this point, Robach is backing up ABC publicly. Salem host Sebastian Gorka spoke with O'Keefe. He begins by playing a large portion of the leaked audio of Robach.
First of all, I was told, who's Jeffrey Epstein? No one knows who that is. This is a stupid story. Then the palace found out that we had her whole allegations about Prince Andrew and threatened us a million different ways. We were so afraid we wouldn't be able to interview Kate and Will that also quashed the story. And then Alan Dershowitz was also implicated in because of the planes. She told me everything. She had pictures. She had everything. She was in hiding for 12 years. We convinced her to come out. We convinced her to talk to us. It was unbelievable what we had. Clinton. We had everything. I tried for 3 years to get it on to no avail, and now it's all coming out, and it's like these new revelations, and I freaking had all of it. I'm so pissed right now. Like, every day I get more and more pissed because I'm just like, oh my God, what we had was unreal. Other women backing it up, Brad Edwards, the attorney, 3 years ago saying, there will come a day when we will realize Jeffrey Epstein was the most prolific pedophile this country has ever known. And I had it all 3 years ago.
That is the latest blockbuster from Project Veritas. It's just a fraction of the video that was released by James O'Keefe's team. Can I give you a little bit of constructive, it's not criticism, just commentary on this latest incredible
Perfect.
Story. The CNN story, which was, what, a couple of weeks ago that you broke, maybe 2 weeks ago, three
yes.
weeks ago? That was mind-bending that you had the evidence, you had the audio that this is a propaganda outlet, and from the very top, from Zucker on down, they see themselves as political activists. But this one, because it's video, because it's in the studio with the green screen, because it's somebody that's recognizable talking to their producer, this is even more powerful. My question to you, do you think the quality of what you've broken today means that there will finally be some consequences, because what you've released is a cover-up at ABC for 3 years of the most prolific, you heard her words, Amy Robach said, the most prolific pedophile ring in America. What is your expectation as the man, the guerrilla journalist who brought us this incredible story, James O'Keefe?
That's a good question. Everyone wants to know what's the actual impact. And sometimes I say to you that to inform your fellow citizens is maybe the greatest impact, because this story, Sebastian, is the number one. It was the top banner on Twitter.com. It was the top story on Apple News, Barstool Sports, the Daily Beast, the Associated Press. This is not a right wing. That CNN story was not mentioned by one blue checkmark journalist. Not one. They didn't utter it was 1.2 million tweets, but it wasn't. They didn't want. It was like Pravda. They didn't want to mention my name. They're very good at that. This story is different. This story is an on-the-record ABC News anchor woman who's a very decent person and very good journalist, angry at her management of that network for spiking a legitimate news story. And by the way, if you substitute the word Clinton, I'm going to quote her here. She says, quote, "We had Clinton," that's Bill Clinton, quote, "we had everything." If you had substituted that word for Trump, we had Trump, we had accusers against Trump, they never would have spiked the story. So people are angry right now. I mean, this thing is the biggest story by order of viral magnitude of anything I have ever seen. And this, and the great thing about it is that I did not send an infiltrator. This was an insider who was working or is working for ABC News. He's still there.
So this wasn't somebody that you sent into ABC News. This was somebody who's on the payroll, working there, who said, I have to give this to somebody, and then they sent it to you, James?
Yes, that is correct. And the word that he or she used to describe why they gave this tape to us is that they were, quote, infuriated. And it's not just one person. Multiple people within the network are in touch with us now. They are angry at these individuals who are at the top. This is a man named James Goldston, president of ABC News, who worked on the decision to spike, that's cancel the story, to protect powerful people. It's not my words, Sebastian. It's not my suspicions. It's the words of Amy Robach, GMA anchor for ABC News.
What should happen in an ideal world now after you've released this, James?
In an ideal world, let's say, for example, just to give you an understanding of basic concepts of fairness and justice, that a network did not air legitimate news and they had real, credible witnesses and allegations against, say, Trump. They would fire the entire investigative division and replace the president. The board of directors would replace the president of ABC News. He needs to be held accountable. The president of ABC News needs to come out and say, here's why we protected, here's the individuals we protected, and admit the real reasons.
Coming up, Israel is surrounded by danger.
It's 130,000 rockets in the hands of Hezbollah in Lebanon, missiles in Syria, missiles in Iraq, missiles in Yemen that can reach the state of Israel, and missiles in Iran itself.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Israel is surrounded by enemies, many of whom have openly expressed their desire to see that nation utterly destroyed. Iran is the growing threat, leading with the worst rhetoric. Some believe those two nations are dangerously close to war. I spoke with Michael Oren, former Israeli ambassador to the United States. He wrote an article earlier this week in The Atlantic titled, "The Coming Middle East Conflagration." The first day of full-scale combat looks like what, Michael Oren?
It looks like this. Israel, Greg, we don't take credit for this, but Israel acts to prevent Iran from establishing itself militarily in Syria with bases, rocket sites, airfields, in Lebanon, and it has been reported to you also in Iraq. One of these operations triggers an Iranian response, because Iran feels that there's really no deterrence and America no longer is standing beside its Middle East allies as it once did, and Iran could get away with striking back. Israel then retaliates, and it snowballs. It mushrooms, whatever metaphor you want. And before you know it, missiles are raining down on the state of Israel. Now, Iran has moved in recent years to surround Israel with a belt of missiles. It's 130,000 rockets in the hands of Hezbollah in Lebanon, missiles in Syria, missiles in Iraq, missiles in Yemen that can reach the state of Israel, and missiles in Iran itself. The IDF estimate is for anything between 1,000 and 4,000 rockets per day. And with all due credit to Iron Dome, it's 90% effective, but for every 100 rockets, 10 are going to get through. But the enemy also has precision-guided rockets that can outfox Iron Dome and hit our airport. It'll close our airport. It'll hit our oil refineries, our ammonia factories. It will close down our electrical grids and our major ports through which all of our food is imported. And millions of Israelis will be in bomb shelters. That's on the first day.
If only 10% of the missiles get through, the casualties in Israel will be unlike any Israel has suffered, ever. And the response that would then be obligatory on the IDF and the political leadership, whoever it might be after this ghastly deadlock is over, would also be obligatory. And that raises the question, which I had at the end of reading your piece in The Atlantic, aren't we on the edge of preemptive action by Israel? Don't we have to be?
That begs the question, preemptive action against what and where? Because we are an address, Hugh, okay? Those rockets have an address. To whom do we strike back? The 130,000 rockets in the hands of Hezbollah, for example, are embedded deeply under 200 villages in southern Lebanon. They're in the houses, Hugh. A house has a missile in the living room. The roof opens up. The missile gets fired. If we strike back, we're going to have to strike back at the village and blow up the house with the family in it, which will expose us then on the third day of the war to Security Council condemnations of disproportionality, of war crimes, and the enemy will try to achieve economic strangulation through Israel through blockades and sanctions.
The problem here is not southern Lebanon. The problem here is Tehran. Isn't that what has to be being discussed at the highest levels today?
Well, what the Saudis would call cutting off the head of the snake.
Yes.
And I don't think we can rule it out. And the article makes that clear, that eventually, or either in the first phase or in one of the early stages, that we're going to have to direct our defensive message against Tehran itself.
Now, in the article, you said the most important question is what will America do? And you're fairly confident we'll do what we usually do, which is resupply Israel with their ammunition, provide legal cover, provide diplomatic support. But the real question is, what will American troops do? And then you raise the question of what about American political leadership? If war is going to come, you actually couldn't hope for a better group of people in charge of America's response than are presently at the controls, could you?
You could not, and I do have full faith in them. But the United States and the American people have proven that they are tired of Middle Eastern wars. And the question is, will the American people want to be involved actively in a Middle Eastern conflict? What I mean actively, that is American forces actually engaging in combat for the benefit of an American ally. And that's a very crucial question. And it's a crucial question that Israelis have to ask themselves.
For the rest of my conversation with Michael Oren, go to townhallreview.com. In the middle of all the danger we face worldwide, the Democrats continue on their path to impeach President Donald Trump, just a year away from election. But in the process, a problem has developed for Joe Biden, former vice president under Obama and Democrat frontrunner. Reporter John Solomon claims Biden forced Ukraine to fire the prosecutor investigating Hunter Biden's company for corruption. He discussed his findings with Sebastian Gorka.
What is the documentary evidence that now has been released upon which you built this article, John?
Well, what we now know is that between 2015 and 2016, Hunter Biden, his business partner, Devin Archer, and the Burisma Holdings Gas Company had multiple contacts with his father's State Department, the Obama State Department, then run by John Kerry. One of those contacts occurs in late February 2016. This is a critical time frame. It is 1 month before Joe Biden goes to Ukraine and forces the firing of the chief prosecutor, a prosecutor who at that very moment was investigating Hunter Biden's company for corruption. It occurs 3 weeks after the prosecutor, who's about to be fired, launches a raid and seizes the property and cars and home of Hunter Biden's boss at Burisma, the owner of Burisma, an oligarch by the name of Zolochevsky, Mykola Zolochevsky. So there's a raid. Joe Biden's about to fire the guy who instigated the raid. And in between that, Burisma shows up at the State Department with their American lawyer lobbyist representative. And she makes a very strong case to the State Department. We need your help ending these corruption allegations in Ukraine about Burisma. And she specifically invokes as a reason why the State Department should help her that Hunter Biden is on the board of directors. If you ever wanted to see how influence peddling occurs in Washington and how people invoke the name of famous people to get something done, this is a classic thing. It's all captured in contemporaneous emails. The email suggests that this representative got a meeting on March 1st, less than 28 days before Joe Biden effects the firing of the prosecutor. A day after that, March 2nd, 2016, we see a notation that Hunter Biden's business partner, fellow Burisma board member, Devin Archer, meets with John Kerry. And then, of course, we know what Joe Biden did on March 29th when he got the prosecutor fired. All of this, remember, is occurring in a very important time. It's the beginning of the presidential election. The Trump v. Clinton race had just begun. And behind the scenes, there was an effort to keep the Burisma corruption story from bursting in the public.
And this prosecutor, Shokin, told you that he was just about to interview Hunter Biden about his work with Burisma. Correct?
That's correct. That's right. So he had just raided the owner's home and seized his assets. He was making plans to interview Hunter Biden and other Americans on the board and the board of directors that was giving supervision to the company. And he says flatly, and he told this to me and ABC News and I believe the Washington Post as well, that he was told when he was fired not because he was an ineffective corruption prosecutor like Joe Biden says. He was told by Ukrainians he was fired because he refused to stand down the investigation of Burisma, and that upset Joe Biden.
Coming up, another look at the Founding Fathers.
Let's debate them on their merits, and let's have real arguments about it instead of pretending that America's founders prohibited those sorts of things.
The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. The idea that America's founders were shaped by a Christian worldview has been a given for over 200 years. It's in the documents they created, the government they formed, the letters they wrote. It's everywhere. But in an increasingly secular world, that's an uncomfortable fact. And many have gone to great lengths to explain it away. David Hall, author of Did America Have a Christian Founding? Examined the evidence while on Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Prof and Amy Jacobson.
The question as to whether America did or did not have a Christian founding, this is in controversy?
Absolutely it is. I take issue at what might even be called a scholarly consensus. Academic after academic, popular author after popular author, writes books saying things like most of America's founders were deists. They created a godless constitution and they built a wall of separation between church and state. In the book, I sort of line up all of these myths, by which I mean a false story, and I'd like to think I demolish them. There's just very little historical evidence to support these widespread claims.
The academic rewriting of American history, which, by the way, now is getting to the area of rewriting when our country was founded altogether, much less the basis on which it was founded. I mean, the 1619 Project suggests that's the real founding of America, right? So the rewriting of American history, the redefinition of American history, if you will, by these academics, it's purposeful, isn't it? It's the to undermine the idea that America was founded on Judeo-Christian values is to undermine the sense that America has any moral authority or that there is anybody has any moral authority, right? We're in the era of the famous inscription that Rusty Reno always references in the 60s in Paris. It is forbidden to forbid. That's where academics want America to be.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So a lot of the scholarship I'm talking about is scholarship from the mid-20th century, and it continues to the present day. And I think to the extent to which there's an ideological motivation, they want to argue that America had this wonderful Enlightenment founding. The founders were rationalists, and they wanted these sorts of outcomes I mentioned before. The 1619 Project takes it a step further to say basically America is founded in this grave evil of slavery, and pretty much nothing redeems it from that, and so we have to atone for it. Now, I would be the first to admit that slavery is a grave moral evil,
sure.
But I would also argue that it's precisely because of their Christian convictions that some founders were starting to question this, that something like 8 states voluntarily abolished slavery between 1776 and 1808. And of course, when the abolitionist movement gets up and running in the 19th century, this is a profoundly Christian movement. And so thank goodness America was founded founded by Christians, that had a Christian founding. And I think this eventually led to the elimination of slavery, which, as a bloody civil war, hadn't been necessary to bring this about. I'm not sure it was absolutely necessary, but of course, as history played out, that's what happened. But you're right, there is an ideological agenda behind this. There are also some more practical agendas, if you'd like to talk about that later.
And the practical agenda behind your book, is it at least in part to sort of reconnect more Americans to their founding for the purposes of resuscitating values that were informed the founding?
You know, that would be a wonderful outcome. America's founders were absolutely convinced that religion is necessary for morality, and morality is necessary if we were to be a republic. And they were convinced of that to a person. And by religion, they meant Christianity. And so I certainly would pray for revival in that respect. But frankly, I'm happy to make common cause with my with Christians of all stripes, and with a clear agenda. The U.S. Supreme Court in 1947 in Everson versus the Board of Education said we must interpret the First Amendment in light of the founders' views. Thomas Jefferson and James Madison equal the American founders. It's been used to deny tax-exempt status to churches, to say we can't fund private religious schools on the same terms as other private schools, that we can't grant religious accommodations to protect minorities from being drafted and this sort of thing. It's a very pernicious doctrine, and it's a doctrine that has absolutely no foundation in the American founding.
Well, the Freedom From Religion Foundation has the perfect name, because in its name it incorporates the entire movement's complete misunderstanding of the First Amendment and the Establishment Clause. There's no language about separation of church and state. The Establishment Clause is the state shall not establish a national religion. And so that's the test that needs to be applied to these questions about religiosity in the public space.
Simply put, the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law respecting the establishment of religion. This means at least we aren't going to have a national church. The Establishment Clause has since been applied to the states, and so now Illinois can't create a state church either. But other than that, almost anything goes. Governors can issue calls for prayer and fasting or give Thanksgiving Day proclamations. Illinois, if it wanted to, could choose to provide vouchers so that parents could send their children to religious schools. They would need to be neutral, I contend. So if you wouldn't want to just fund Catholic schools, right? You want to provide vouchers so parents could send their kids to a Jewish school or a Protestant school or a Catholic school or whatever, but perfectly constitutional. So let's just get away from this bad history and debate the merits of calls for prayer and fasting or vouchers or memorials. Let's debate them on their merits, and let's have real arguments about it instead of pretending that America's founders prohibited those sorts of things.
Coming up.
That commencement thing I did for PragerU was important to me because it was personal. And now it's doubly important because it's one of the restricted videos.
Mike Rowe and the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment. Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. My friend and Salem colleague Dennis Prager struck gold with his PragerU videos. And it's gold for the kids who watch them, and especially the people in college who watch them. In them, people from various viewpoints discuss topics ranging from socialism to the wage gap. The videos are enormously popular and educational. In one of the PragerU videos, Mike Rowe, best known for his Dirty Jobs program on the Discovery Channel, discussed career choices. He joined Salem host Dennis Prager.
Yours is about don't follow your passion, which is so counter to what people think. The number of homes that I have been to where I've given a talk or done a fundraiser for PragerU or something, where I will see a sign in these wonderful people's homes. I mean, these are wonderful people. I wouldn't be in their home otherwise. Follow your heart.
Well, it's feelings, you know. My message is not don't be passionate.
You I know.
Be passionate.
You are passionate.
Whatever it is.
That's right.
I'm very passionate.
Yes.
But passion, it's too important a thing to follow around or to be led around by. And it was one of the great lessons that came out of Dirty Jobs. That was, as a group, those were some very passionate people. But none of them looked around and said, ah, septic tank cleaner, right there. There's my wish fulfillment. You know, they simply saw an opportunity, took a reverse commute, if you will, learned how to be good at the work, and then learned how to be passionate about it. It's pretty much the exact opposite of what we tell our kids today. You know, today we say, listen, the first key to being happy and the first key to job satisfaction is to identify in your mind the thing that will allow you to feel that way. And then we go through this whole list of things you have to do to get there, including, unfortunately, in many cases, borrowing vast sums of money to get a four-year credential that leads to way. Eventually, right, you get the job of your dreams, and then you can be happy. It's actually the precise opposite of that, I think. You know, you start looking not for the proximate cause of your bliss, but for a genuine opportunity and work it from there.
I hear from employers that the work ethic is weaker among young people today than, let's say, young people 50 years ago. Is that true?
I've certainly heard the same thing. And look, the millennials are an easy target, and I'm not super comfortable cutting or painting with such a broad brush. You know, I often say that we are the clouds from which the snowflakes fell. And I think to some degree, expectations have changed. I do think work ethic has changed because I think the definition of a good job has changed. So the reason I started my foundation, which primarily looks for kids who are willing to learn a skill that's truly in demand and doesn't require a four-year degree, is to celebrate work ethic. I see lots of scholarships out there that focus on academic achievement or talent or athleticism. But to circle back and affirmatively say, look, work ethic is still a thing that paired up with the mastery of a truly useful skill will allow you to prosper. So it was that absence of work ethic, at least as described to me by hundreds of small business owners on Dirty Jobs, that convinced me that it would make sense to set up some kind of fund and some sort of campaign that tries to shine a light on right now 7.3 million open opportunities, many of which don't require a degree.
Okay, I want to talk to you about that last thing about requiring a degree. Unless it's a very specific skill in engineering or medicine, in other words, STEM, science, technology, I don't understand why a college degree is necessary for anything.
I doubt that it is in the same way that it used to be. You know, 30 or 40 years ago, part of what I paid for, anyway, in the early 80s, was access. I didn't have access to anything other than a library, you know, in terms of accessing information that was truly going to be useful in a liberal arts background. So my liberal arts degree served me well, but it cost $11,000. That's 3 years in a community college and 2 years in a university. And the exact same thing today would cost $92,000. I did the math. I went through the exact curricula and added it up. So at some point, you can't have the conversation of value in a vacuum. You can't talk about a college education purely as an investment in your future. You have to do some kind of practical calculus. And today, we have something that that we didn't have in 1983. We have a smartphone, and if you have an internet connection, you now have access to 98% of the known information in the world. I watched a lecture last night from MIT for free. Anybody can do this. So I'm not comparing a deep dive on YouTube with an actual four-year degree. I'm just saying that one costs hundreds of thousands of dollars and the other doesn't. And at some point, we're going to have to figure out where it tips. And I would suggest that it already has. $1.5 trillion in student loans are on the books. Your movie with Adam Carolla is damned important because the safe space mentality is festering underneath of all of this, and it's metastasizing. And all of it is connected. Our work ethic, our definition of a good job, a definition of a good education, the cost of all of the above, it's all intertwined into our expectations. And we have to push back on it in whatever way we can. And the point I wanted to make in the last segment was that commencement thing I did for PragerU was important to me because it was personal. And now it's doubly important because it's one of the restricted videos. I got it unrestricted.
That is unbelievable. Unbelievable. How did you get it unrestricted?
I've got 5.5 million people on my Facebook page. I just went there and said, look, this can't happen. I just gave a 6-minute commencement speech that dared to suggest that the best path for the most people might not be the most expensive path, and that your dreams, as they exist right now in your mind, might not be the best example of true north for you to follow.
To hear Dennis' complete conversation with Mike Rowe, go to townhallreview.com. Coming up, the trouble with a rising minimum wage.
Young people, immigrants who don't have the job skills necessary to support a minimum wage at that level simply do not find jobs.
Stick around for the final segment of the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. With the minimum wage increase in New York City, a large number of restaurants were forced to simply shut down. Others laid off workers. Regardless, many in the media insist it's a good thing for society to keep raising the minimum wage. Larry Elder jumped on one particular article out of New York Magazine that praised the higher wage. He invited UCLA economics professor Leo Hanen on the Larry Elder Show.
The first paragraph of the article called Why New York's Minimum Wage Increase basically says, all these people were talking about gloom and doom, and now it turns out the legislation, quote, has been pretty good for restaurants and restaurant workers so far, close quote. So these dumb people that ran these restaurants, Lee, didn't realize if they paid their workers more money, they'd be making even more money.
Yes, it's always interesting when someone from the outside can tell them can give them advice to lose money and then claim that it actually helped them to help them to make money. I'm surprised these people aren't asking them for a piece of the action. This is the piece you're citing is just one of the silliest pieces of economics I've seen in quite some time.
Wow. And if it's having all these wonderful effects, Lee, why don't we just boost the minimum wage to $50 an hour? That way everybody makes $100,000 a year, no downside.
Yes, $50 an hour or $100 an hour, and then, you know, just the economy is just taking off and going right to the moon. Everybody would just be delighted. That's the exact logic that people should think about when they read stories like this. It's just the worst economics possible. There is absolutely no question among economists about what happens with the minimum wage. The most careful studies always, and I mean, when I say always, I mean about 98 times out of 100, show that job loss is sizable, and those who actually keep their jobs are better off because they're getting paid a bit more. But what these people don't understand is that there's a whole group of people out there who are just locked outside the gates. They are locked outside. They cannot get a job because at this stage of their careers, they might be very young people, they might be immigrants. These are the people who presumably the legislators who are passing these laws are supposed to be representing. Young people, immigrants who don't have the job skills necessary to support a minimum wage at that level simply do not find jobs. And it's completely unfair, and it's just patently a very, very bad policy.
Professor, I've asked you this question before. I'm asking again. Why is it that that you, meaning your profession, can't win this debate? You look at the polls, the majority of Americans support minimum wage, especially Democrats.
The problem with, the reason why we're not winning the war is that economics cannot be distilled down to just one-liners and one-sentences, which is what a lot of politicians want to peddle.
Thanks for joining us for this edition on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes at our website, townhallreview.com, and sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producers Russell Shubin and producers Charlie Richard, David Posey and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey, Ben Brigman, and Dwayne Patterson. Let me say once again thanks to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Thank you for joining us.